It's 7:43. I'm Teresa Wills. All this week on West Virginia Morning, we're featuring stories about how kids are being affected by this coronavirus pandemic, including some of the state's most vulnerable.
I think we always, as public educators, we think that we know a good bit about our students. And what this has really shown me is that I could know a lot more.
That story and more coming up on this West Virginia Morning. Food banks and pantries across the Ohio Valley are seeing a spike in demand as a record number of people are filing for unemployment. Meanwhile, some farmers are facing a financial crisis setting on excess food they can't sell. On Friday, the United States Department of Agriculture said it would provide at least $3 billion to purchase excess farm products to send to food banks. Liam Nehemiah has more on efforts to send that food to food banks and provide some relief to farmers.
Tona Casey runs the Murray Calloway County Needline Food Pantry in West Kentucky, and she's put together hundreds of food packages to hand out, including to people who are recently unemployed.
And they would be crying, going, I just didn't know what I was going to do. And, you know, you put the food in their car and they're just like, thank you, thank you, thank you. It's been bittersweet.
She says her pantry has seen a 30% spike in demand since mandated business shutdowns began. And while her pantry has enough food, some food banks in the Ohio Valley are facing logistical challenges in getting certain items. Cynthia Kirkhart is the director of Facing Hunger Food Bank in Huntington, West Virginia, where they've seen a 50% increase in demand.
Product that I used to be able to order and get within a week or 2 weeks at max is now, you know, 4 to 6 weeks, and then worst case scenario, 6 to 8 weeks.
Kirkhart is competing with hundreds of food banks across the country for the same products, causing the price of things like eggs to more than double.
We're serving the needs of about 250 agencies. You know, some of those folks went from serving 100 families to 400 families.
These food pantries and food banks need food. And the people who have extra of it right now, farmers.
But obviously no one could have seen this coming.
That's Daniel Hayden, who runs 8 poultry houses in West Kentucky that put out more than 1 million chickens a year. He says because workers at meatpacking plants are getting sick with the coronavirus across the country, production is slowing down. He says his region hasn't been affected yet, but the potential of shuttered processing plants could leave chickens, livestock, and hogs stuck on farms.
The big concern is we're going to have to depopulate those chicken houses that are full to 50%. And that is euthanizing 50% of those chickens because they literally cannot be processed.
The dairy industry is in a similar situation. Chuck Mullendick is a dairy farmer in central Ohio who knows someone sitting on extra milk.
He has 3 farms, and he is dumping 3 tanker loads of milk a day from each farm.
He says dairy cooperatives would guarantee farmers receive at least some compensation for dumped milk. Independent farmers are getting hit harder.
A friend of ours went up to talk to him about buying some baby calves from him. He said he's in tears.
Meanwhile, government officials and advocates are trying to solve both of these issues in the food supply chain. Feeding America and the American Farm Bureau co-signed a letter to Congress advocating for a voucher program. Farmers with extra supply could work directly with food banks. And for farmers like Greg Gibson in West Virginia, he wants to help. He's been able to sell milk to processors, but prices have been depressed.
The last thing dairy farmers want to see is milk being put down the drain. You know, if we have to give it away, we would rather give it away than put it down the drain. That's the last resort.
If he can directly help those in need instead, he's all for it. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
The Ohio Valley Resource is made possible with support from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and West Virginia Public Broadcasting. For many children in West Virginia, school is a respite. It's a place where they go to get 2 meals a day and where teachers and counselors keep watchful eyes over them. But schools have been closed for a month. and will remain closed for at least another 2 weeks due to the coronavirus pandemic. The situation has child welfare workers concerned that children in vulnerable situations may be going unnoticed. Emily Corio has the story.
Thanks for calling Davis Child Shelter. This is DJ. How may I help you?
At an emergency shelter operated by the Children's Home Society of West Virginia, Delvin Johnson's days are now spent helping kids do schoolwork and trying to keep them active while not being allowed to leave the shelter's grounds.
These kids have been very resilient. They've been very brave. They help and staff. They understand what's going on in the world.
The shelter is a temporary home to 10 kids ages 12 and older. They are some of the more than 7,200 children currently in West Virginia's foster care system. Agencies that oversee children once they enter the system are trying to help kids cope in new ways. Siblings sent to different placements have been connected through video chats. Visitations with biological parents are happening over video, too. Where the technology isn't available, foster parents are sending photos through the mail. But child welfare workers are concerned that with school being closed due to the coronavirus, child abuse or neglect may go unreported. Teachers and school counselors are mandatory reporters. And since schools closed, referrals to the state's Child Protective Services are down, way down. According to the West Virginia Department of Health and Human Resources, referrals were at least 49% lower between March 13th and April 13th than during any month over the past year. Angie Hamilton Thomas is an executive director with Presley Ridge, which offers youth education, treatment, and foster care programs. She's worried about the stress some already fragile families may be under.
You know, if you think about kids and families being, kind of more shut in, more isolated in a lot of areas, some of the mental health issues and problems that families and kids face can be escalated.
So agency workers are checking in with clients online or over the phone more frequently than when visits were in person. They're looking for signs of distress that would prompt an in-person visit, even during a stay-at-home order and social distancing.
We would practice the safety precautions, we would practice the CDC guidelines, but we would still have an obligation to be responsive to those families.
Meanwhile, school counselors like Cindy Rubenstein are finding new ways to connect with their students. At Anna Jarvis Elementary School in Taylor County, Rubenstein would talk to kids going through all sorts of situations, from academic struggles to parents getting divorced. When school was first canceled, Rubenstein joined efforts to deliver meals to students' doorsteps on behalf of the school system. She didn't expect that this small gesture would in turn give her a wider perspective on what life is like for some of her students.
I think we always, as public educators, we think that we know a good bit about our students. And what this has really shown me is that I could know a lot more.
More recently, a nonprofit group has taken over meal delivery, and she's checking on students over the phone.
At this point, there have been a few that I've not been able to get in contact with, which is worrisome.
After following up with state caseworkers, she learned all are okay. But child advocates say they are still concerned some kids are falling through the cracks. For West Virginia Public Broadcasting, I'm Emily Corio.
Tune in all this week on West Virginia Morning to hear more reporting on how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting kids and caregivers. In the mid-20th century, Charleston, West Virginia was a major stop for Black musicians who traveled to Baltimore and D.C. on what was known as the Chitlin Circuit. Most of them came to visit and play shows inside a neighborhood known as the Triangle. It was one of West Virginia's most culturally diverse communities, but it was decimated in the 1960s and 70s. The Inside Appalachia team has been listening to the stories of residents and those who used to visit the neighborhood before Urban Renewal, a water company, and a major interstate overpass replaced hundreds of homes and businesses. Let's listen to an excerpt of the story reported by Eric Douglas and Roxy Todd.
Danny Jones finished a 16-year tenure as Charleston's mayor in 2019. He grew up in the city and empathizes with the loss of a community with such a rich, vibrant history. Jones is white, but he often visited the Triangle District. He even worked in a popular neighborhood restaurant called the Sterling.
The Triangle was a neat place. It had a lot of character. I was so happy I got to know some of those folks and waited on a lot of them at the Sterling. And the people that were engaged in the vice, they were good tippers.
What Danny Jones is referring to when he says vice are the three notorious activities that went down in homes throughout the Triangle, starting years before interstate construction was ever considered. There was prostitution, gambling, and lots of illegal drinking.
Back then, there wasn't a law in the books that allowed bars to sell liquor by the drink. There was an understanding, though, that clubs would operate like this illegally in neighborhoods like the Triangle. And so lots of restaurants, like the one Jones worked at, were open late.
And there were no hours on them. I'd get off work 6 o'clock in the morning, and there'd still be people going in and out of those clubs.
Larry Moore grew up in the Triangle. Though he was just a kid in the 1950s, he later learned that his neighborhood featured a lively nightlife with brothels, illegal bars, and gambling.
Oh, Court Street was notorious. It was known worldwide. You could find everything and anything on Court Street.
But it wasn't just the red light district. The Triangle was also famous because of the musicians who came here. Mike Jones's grandmother ran one of the neighborhood brothels and an illegal liquor bar out of her home.
Oh, James Brown came by my grandmother's house.
Yes, he is talking about the James Brown. Musicians who were on tour playing shows in D.C. or Baltimore would often pass through Charleston, sometimes to play a show or just to have a drink of moonshine.
They would leave their gigs there and stop in Charleston, West Virginia. And they always stopped in my grandmother's kitchen.
And Mike Jones often snuck downstairs to watch and listen to James Brown.
So I was supposed to be in bed. And they were sitting there getting drunk and laughing. And he would start singing and dancing because they had the jukebox going on. And I remember one time, I can't remember if it was his song or nothing. He was dancing and doing his little thing. And all of a sudden he did a split. And I was like, wide-eyed. You know, Cab Calloway was in my grandmother's kitchen, you know, because he and my grandfather were good friends. And so they'd get there drinking that corn liquor, and next thing you know, Cab Calloway was up there singing, my grandfather was singing, and it was just like a big party.
Hey, folks, here's a story about Minnie the Moocher. She was a low-down, hoochie-coocher.
Jazz musician Bob Thompson moved to Charleston in the late 1960s. Back in those days, he recalls that musicians often stayed up all night playing bebop or improv jazz at many of the clubs throughout the Triangle.
You know, Charleston used to be a stop on what they used to call the Chitlin Circuit, you know, where musicians used to come through here all the time. And there were musicians, there was a great piano player who was from Philadelphia who played around D.C. His name was Fats Wright, and he was an Art Tatum type piano player, and he would just come to Charleston and stay, you know, for a month or so, just playing and hanging out, you know. And so there was that kind of history, you know.
And Thompson says the music and the lively night scene were very integrated.
And the thing about it is that the musicians, you know, both black and white, all played together, you know. There was, you know, I know in other cities they had separate musicians' unions, but not in Charleston. The musicians were always together, you know, and I thought that was, I took it for granted until I saw what was happening in other places.
The historic Triangle neighborhood was demolished in 1974, displacing hundreds of residents. To hear the rest of the story, download the most recent Inside Appalachia podcast at wvpublic.org. West Virginia Morning is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, which is solely responsible for its content. You can keep up with the latest West Virginia news throughout the day on our website, wvpublic.org. Support for our news bureaus comes from West Virginia University, Concord University, and Shepherd University. Brittany Patterson produces our show. Our news director is Glennis Board. I'm Teresa Wills.